Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Thriving Adoptees podcast. So today I'm delighted to be joined by Paul Kimball. Nice to see you, Paul. Thank you for getting up a little bit early to see us and speak to us.
My pleasure, Simon.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a while since I've had a fellow adoptee guy on the show. It's been mainly women, I think, recently. So yeah, it's good to see the gender balance, coming in,
Sure, because we're creeping out under our rocks.
Yeah, well, we men, we're not good at talking about emotional stuff, right? So that's the thing. We suppress it and we don't talk about it. And apparently the women are doing all the stuff. So here's one for the guys today.
There you go.
There we go. We're not afraid to get emotional here. So Paul is an adoptee. He's a musical guy. So you were talking about leading a musical production of Oliver. Is that right?
Yeah, that's my latest adventure right now. I'm a musical conductor as well as a choir director in the public schools, but I'm conducting Oliver, the musical, and it's really wonderful. What I would say is to musically direct means you're conducting a pit orchestra with the singers that we've all trained. But the most important thing is during a performance, you are feeling your way through that whole story.
Yeah.
So when little Oliver, the orphan, sings "Where is Love?" it is so significant, I think, to all of us adoptees. Because at that point, Oliver has escaped his original fate of being in an orphanage / working for an undertaker, and is somewhere between where he started and working his way towards London. So it makes me think of all of us that have been in foster care or that world of between the trauma and where we're going next. And in the adoption experience, that is almost the scariest thing, is that no man, no woman's land of where are we? And when she sings "Where is Love?" she's asking, where'd my birth mother go, in a way? Even though she's been told that, or he, ours is played by a girl, even though he's been told that the birth mother has passed.
Yeah.
So what brought me on Sunday's performance, it got me very emotional while I was in the pit. Number one, it's Sunday, meaning you just did four of them over a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and you can finally relax, which brings out even more things. Was beyond the "Where is Love?" Oliver does start connecting with his birth family. I mean, that's what Dickens wrote. And so there's a point where he's looking out the window and one of the sellers on the streets, one of them is singing, "Who will buy my sweet red roses?" And I started equating that character and three others that come on as my adopted family, because I am one of the ones who did end up with a spectacular adopted family. And that's where, when we were talking about the whirlwind of emotions, I started getting not conflicted, but just the realization that I would be horrified if I had not met them and been with them. And yet, of course, I wanted my birth mother. And of course, I had that traumatic feeling. But it also gave me some peace, I think, of knowing that where I am now, the trauma is still there, but I'm thrilled to have had the adopted family that I had. And I know that's not the case for everybody.
Yeah. Wow. So poetically put. for a musician. Yeah, I mean, they go together, don't they?
Yes.
I'm a little bit, I was saying this on a podcast yesterday, I think, or a conversation, I'm a little bit more left brain than right brain. I was at school anyway. I think I'm getting more in touch with my right brain side these days. Yeah, I was in a little school or a class production of Oliver. And I just remember I think it was around Christmas, because it is it's a Christmassy theme, isn't it? You know, I just remember it was really cold in the big hall, you know. I was one of the backing chorus of street urchins, orphans, whatever. And, you know, I had to hack up a pair of trousers, of old trousers to look sufficiently, urchin-like.
Sure.
But as you started singing the Where Is Love, I went straight to watching the program, the Mark Lester, the adaptation, the film adaptation.
Brilliant.
I think with Mark Lester, who was this cute little blonde, pale-skinned young guy, and like it was an epic performance. But I don't think he did anything. I don't know what happened to him after that. But he did very little. You know, he was tipped. Did he peak too early? I don't know. But the emotion of where is love? You know, like we're looking outside.
Yes.
We're looking outside ourselves for love. You know, did a podcast on this yesterday with an Aussie called Vin, Aussie adoptee. And yeah, we're from birth, we're looking outside, aren't we?
Yes.
We're looking outside. And
it's so much to put on a kid. That's so much to ask of somebody. To have to look outside, like you said, from the get-go. So it's not the normal growing up with your birth parents and rebelling and having arguments, and but probably always knowing that, wait a minute, they're going to keep me because they're my birth parents. We Olivers of the world don't exactly have that, which in a way makes us super strong if we can withstand that.
I'd say it reveals our strength. This is one of my things. This fact that the world is trying to, as in the consumerist world, the producers of goods and services are trying, know that we're emotionally driven, and are trying to sell us their products on the basis of the way that we're going to feel. So we're recording this in the run-up to Christmas, and all the food producers and supermarkets are telling us that we need to stuff our faces.
Yes.
But the adverts after Christmas will be all about dry January, losing weight, and you know, joining the gym.
I love that. For 2 weeks. Yeah.
and they'll be saying that, you know, you need to be better. We can help you feel better.
Right.
We can help you feel stronger. And this idea is that resilience or strength is built. So it's built at the gym. Physical strength is built at the gym. And emotional strength is built by going on courses with people. You know, the coaches and this and the personal development people say, you are weak. You feel weak. We can help you feel strong. Pay us and we'll show you how to strengthen your resilience. I believe it's one of my things is that strength is revealed through hardship. You know, we we get through something and we think, how on earth did I get through that? Yeah. I didn't think I could get through that, but I did. My strength was revealed, not strengthened. It comes from within, like feelings come from within. And yet we are looking without, we're looking outside ourselves for love, validation, resilience, approval, and so on.
Sure. So if you can recognize that it starts with your own feelings with yourself and not somebody else coming in. So that other song, The Greatest Love of All, learning to love yourself is the greatest love of all. And that's profound. And that's not an outside force coming in saying, here, we're going to help you. You do that yourself. And that's where I have such respect for adoptees and people in foster care, because you're right. It was greatness thrust upon them, maybe, because you're suddenly in the situation, you're a baby, you have to somehow adapt to your circumstances for survival. And if you can find love, if you can accept the reality of what you're in and search for, I don't know, additional love? I'm not sure where I'm going with this. Or the fact that it can be a beautiful day and you're allowed to enjoy that beautiful day like anybody else. I'm not saying that the trauma goes away, but I'm saying that, as my book is called, we are all human beings.
Yeah.
But I like what you're saying, that it's already within you. And if you can give yourself a pat on the back, wow, I did something. Now, yeah. And an adoptee superpower with that, with the pandemic, when we had to shut down, some people were, of course, were completely devastated, as they would be and should be, especially if it's affected their job and their income. I personally was lucky because I could do things online as a music teacher. But in a way, you lose everything. And it was a similar feeling. Oh, I've already been through this before. Kind of know how to hunker down and be with yourself for a while, that self-acceptance.
Yeah. So this feelings are an inside job.
Is
one of my main things, right? So I get on a bit of a roll with this. And you mentioned the weather, and I sometimes think it's easier to point at profound things with trivial things, right? So you're West Coast, California, LA, is it?
Yeah.
So your weather's pretty good, but here in the north of England, you know, we have miserable weather.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we have the opposite. You have storms and we have the droughts.
Yeah. Well, we have miserable weather. Like that is the way people think. 99.9% of the world's population, or the population of Yorkshire, to believe that the weather causes our mood.
Sure.
Have you ever? Have you ever been happy in the rain?
Oh, I love the rain. But I don't think we have a miserable rain.
What sort of freak are you? Sorry, I'm joking.
What'll get us here, though, and it hasn't been bad in a few years, is tule fog. Okay. So that you just can't see anything. And that really gets you. You just want to see some blue sky.
You want to see some blue sky. Yeah. We're going to go back to that in a minute because there's a fog metaphor to play out with the adoption stuff, right? The idea, we're here in the north of England, we're raised on the idea that the weather causes our mood, and you know, we're going to be, we've got this miserable weather, and we're going to be miserable for the duration of the miserable weather. And then when the sun comes out, we're going to be happier. And like, how does that work? It, you know, like it doesn't stand up to experience.
Mm.
So I've been happy. You've been happy in the rain. Right. You've been delighted in the rain. I've been happy in the rain, and I've been sad in the sunshine. So the theory, the cultural belief that the weather causes our mood is incorrect. Because it doesn't stand the test of experience. And sure. Yet, and that for me is, as I say, this thing, this idea that this cultural belief that we are brought up in, that feelings come, you know, that the outside world determines the way we feel inside is never questioned. We're born looking out.
Like you said, in the commercial world, we're bombarded with this is how you should feel. And I think you would agree with this with your stuffed animal, that there are certain emotions that come out that you weren't expecting, that you don't, are not the normal. Oh, I normally feel like this at this time of day, etc. I don't want to quickly go through my whole story, but my birth mother, who was a cellist, who we met, it was good for about 3 months, and then I went through the secondary rejection and knew she was alive for about, I want to say, 12 years. When she passed, I didn't know that she had passed. A couple years later, I found out from just contacting a cellist in an orchestra that she played. But this led to finding out where she was buried over here in California. And I go to where where she's buried. And there's no gravestone. There's no marker. So I contacted the people over there at the cemetery, and they drove up and said, "You're standing right there. Nobody ever got her a marker." And this is somebody who had played Carnegie Hall, did very well. But I was so sad with that. But it was this whole world of emotions that no one is telling me how to feel. But it was that whirlwind. Maybe we were talking about that before. That whirlwind of anger, of confusion, of sadness, of also having found her. I'm finally with her again. What was astonishing to me, by the way, is I then talked to the people in the office there and said exactly who I was. I am her birth son that she gave up for adoption. Can I get her a birthstone or a birth marker, rather? Would you let me design it? And they said, sure. So we did that. And so it appeared about 3 months later. And once a year, I go down and have my peace. And I don't know what's going to come out of me, but a lot comes out. And nobody's there with me. That's my own private world with her. And the recognition that I still stayed with her, even through the secondary rejection. A part of me is still that baby clinging to his mother, his first mother. And I, like I said, I loved my adopted mother, but in this case, this is my own thing. And it's very important for me to go down there and polish up the marker.
Yeah. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. It really is. Because you didn't, like, you had the secondary rejection, but you didn't take it on board.
Well, I did in a way that I was told not to contact her again. And I didn't, except for one time when I had met my birth father and let her know that in a letter, and of course never heard anything. So I never heard anything in all of that.
Yeah.
So that was.
So you respected her wishes, but then when she was died out of respect and feelings concerned for her, or yeah, I mean, is respect the right word? I know. Out of love, was it love for her that you sorted the birth marker, or what would you say? What was the driver?
I just thought she needed to have a birth marker.
Yeah.
Somebody has to do it, and I'm going to do it. And it gave me not ownership, but I was able to do something practical, to do something that said I am connected to her. And little did they know over there at the cemetery, they just called her, what did they say? Probably my loved one or my beloved one. And I thought, wow. Without you thinking about it, because they say that all day, they connected me to her officially. And the fact that they let me do that.
Yeah.
So that's the connection.
Yeah.
There.
There's a few different ways I can take this. Okay, I'll go with the... So I can go back to the fog. I can go to connection, or I can go to a story about a guy called Wayne Dyer and him.
Oh, I remember Wayne Dyer, sure.
Yeah. Have you heard the story about Wayne Dyer going to his father's grave? Have you heard that?
No.
I do talk about it on the show. So Wayne Dyer's dad was an alcoholic. He left his mum and Wayne and Wayne's siblings to fend for themselves. And that's what they did. And he went on a talk show once and he explained the story. It's in one of his books. I used to listen to a lot of Wayne Dyer books a while ago. And he tells a story, a very long, convoluted story of happenstance and luck and breaks and all strange circumstances that led him to his father's grave. He had been angry with his father forever. He went on the grave and he was going to pee on the grave. Right? And he shouted at his dad's grave for 2 hours. He got he let all the anger towards his father out. Wow. And then he had a spontaneous forgiveness experience, mm-hmm. which, you know, he'd got everything out of his system, and then there was a vacuum in there, and love came into the vacuum, right? It's how I kind of remember it. And that set Wayne Dyer free.
Mm.
So his life, the power of that moment, the lifting of the backpack full of lead weights on his back that was keeping him down disappeared. Wow. And his career took off from then. That's how he explains it.
So he came out of his version of the fog, which means we're facing what's there, and we're looking at it, and we're feeling it and acknowledging it. And with that, it set some personal freedom for him to go on with the rest of his life.
Yeah. I would say so. I would say that there's an intermediate stage. So you're talking about no man's land, no woman's land,
yes,
the in-between stage earlier on at the start of the conversation, right?
Yeah. And maybe we're always in that between stage. I don't think you ever reach the finish line and say, hey, everything's fine now, even though sometimes I think that. And then something will happen and I'll think, oh, where did that come from?
Yeah.
There's a lot still in there.
There's a lot still in that. And I wanted to say this earlier on, that the sense that I got as I was listening to you is that you were talking about the feelings coming up,
yes,
with the Oliver musical directorship. And you were feeling the feelings. The feeling that I got is that the trauma was less traumatic.
Well, because I could recognize it. I mean, it got me, because your job is to feel your way through the story. If not, you're not conducting, yeah, well. You're not connecting with your performers. But that just... And so sometimes it gets you. But I think that's a good thing if you can recognize it. Now, it was interesting. When I wrote my book, and the reason that I wrote it was to connect with other adoptees, because when I was in therapy, the therapist suggested that, said, you have quite a story here that a lot of adoptees could relate to and get something out of it. Have you ever considered writing a book? I said, I've never considered writing a book. And then I wrote a book for that reason. And that's why I love this, what we're doing right now, Simon, with connecting with other adoptees. But I didn't know a lot of things, and I'm glad I didn't. It was my own perspective. But now, as I learn about the baby scoop era and what so many of these young ladies were going through, and I suppose some of the fathers as well, that they're coerced to give up their children because, oh, sorry, you don't make enough money. Oh, you were too young, etc. And so the shame that they feel, sometimes they're not going to get over it. And that's what makes one of the reasons that would make these reunions so complicated for them. And so going back to the gravesite, just in a bit like Wayne Dyer, there is some acceptance of what she was going through. Do I wish that when we had met, the relationship had continued all these years, and that she had been able to play literally in the same music groups that I'm in? I would have loved that. That would have been the greatest path. And I wish that she had had the strength to be able to do that, but also to accept her and what she must have been going through, because how else could she reject again her baby? You know, and I'm in general a pretty happy person in the larger world of people, and as a music teacher, etc., that's part of what you do. And so you just think, but I'm so lovable. How could this one person do that and have such an effect on me? And but it does. There's no getting around that. I take a lot of therapeutic hikes now that you and I are Facebook friends. Oh, sure, you look on my feed and there he is again. Oh, there he is taking a picture of a bird or something, or a beautiful sunset. And I'm just doing a lot of self-reflection out there while looking and experiencing the beauty of the world.
Yeah. So I'm going to talk about connection. I'm going to talk about connection with my birth mother, and then I'm going to go back to the fog and the sunshine and stuff. So when I the culmination of my search and reunion process was to find out that my birth mother had died. And I was 99% sure of that, that had happened.
Sure.
And it was confirmed by an uncle who wrote from Canada to confirm that, actually. However, before that had happened, before I'd even actually, yeah, before I'd found that out, I got my adoption file, and in there was this letter from my birth mother about the teddy bear, a letter to the social worker. And in this letter, as I read this letter, I felt her shame.
Sure.
I felt her love for me, and I felt no separation. I felt that me and her were one again.
Yes.
So it was like somebody had taken us back in time, 48 years, done one of those fast rewinds, and put the, resealed the umbilical cord,
Yes.
right?
Wow.
And I was at one with her. And the tears that cascaded down my face as I read that letter washed away 48 years of separation with her,
Yes.
and we were one. We were one.
That's so important. I mean, good for you. That takes an inner courage that you said, yeah, is the inner courage that you have is revealed. And you were one. You were one with her for 9 months, as I was mine. And that initial feeling of comfort, I suppose. I suppose for those 9 months that were there, we're not thinking anything's going to happen like that. You're a team. I had at the gravesite the last time a very similar experience. It's so interesting, by the way, to talk about this on a podcast where I don't know if I've ever spoken to anybody about this except for my wife, but the last time when I was there, there wasn't anybody around. It's a beautiful, beautiful cemetery. I just kind of lay right where she was and suddenly had this feeling that I was inside of her again. I literally felt like a fetus and it scared me. I could not believe that came. But that's yours as well, that we started off with our original mothers. And that's a reality. That's not something made up. That's not something that society has talked to us about or we're going to help you. That's just the way it was. And to acknowledge that initial team, that initial bond that we have with our first mothers is real. And that when we were separated, we were looking back to where is love. We are little Oliver. And it's not easy. But I am determined, which is why I'm here talking to you, to have as good a life, emotional life as I can. And that doesn't mean covering it up. That means acknowledging, feeling through, and at the same time, knowing I have a lovely wife and lovely children and grandchild. And all of us in adoptee land deserve that. And I can't, you and I can't say to somebody else what I just did. Hey, you, that's your own exploration.
Yeah.
And I'm always exploring that.
So when I say, you know, love is an inside job, feelings are an inside job, I mean love too, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, love is an inside job. What I mean by that and how that stacks up with my birth mother is that, and all 7 billion people on there. Well, no, let me slow that down. We are love.
Mm.
You know, love is is forgetting otherness. It's when I did this with Vin yesterday, the Spice Girls song, When Two Become One.
Mm.
Yeah. So two became one, but it's not two, it's an illusion. It's the whole world. You know, like when you've got rose-tinted spectacles on and we're all one. You know, when you're hiking, let me make this a little bit, you know, when you're hiking and the enormity of the world takes your breath away and when the beauty of the world takes away the minutiae of what you're going to buy your grandchild or how are you going to get your car serviced, or do you know what I mean? Like when the logistics of life and the inner critic is gone, and you see this big expanse, and we're part of the universe. That's why it's therapeutic. And there's a guy talks about this. I think it's a Japanese term. So one of the first astronauts was up in space, and he had this Satori experience, which is just like a turbocharged version of what you get when you get to the top of a mountain and you think, done it.
Sure.
He had a Satori, an experience. We have ultimate perspective. We're at the we're at the top of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory's great white elevator. Yeah.
The clarity, the big clarity of
the clarity, the love.
We are part of that whole world. Yeah.
We are that whole world. So love is an inside job because feelings are an inside job because we're the whole world. Love is an inside job because we're the whole world. We're not just this body, right?
Sure.
You know, the spirit, your birth mother, what was her first name?
Wendy.
Wendy. Wendy's spirit, the spirit of Wendy, was not in that body. That's the animating force that was Wendy had left. Elvis has left the building. Wendy has left the body. I saw my father-in-law after he died, and Bill wasn't there. You know, the guy with the twinkle in his eye and a cheeky, yeah, and a slightly quirky Scottish dirty sense of humor, you know, like a schoolboy cheek. You know, he was 75, but there was odd moments you'd get the glimmer of him and he'd wink or something. You know, that spirit of him wasn't there anymore. You know, we're not our bodies. We're this, I say this all the time on the podcast because it's the best quote I've ever heard. Yeah, we're one spiritual being having 7 billion human experiences. There's no separation. You weren't. I sensed I being one with my birth mother, and she died 48 years before. And she was presumably, she was buried 70 miles away from where I live. So there was no physical, there was no physical proximity there, and I never met her, apart from whatever, you know, 55 years ago. So the physical stuff is, the physical proximity is kind of an illusion. It's kind of, it's all one. Love is the absence of otherness. It's when we forget others are others. It's when we are at one, and that takes the whole world away, doesn't it? It takes all the separation away, and we're in love. We're one.
Because yeah, when that astronaut looks down and has that realization, wow, that whole planet is brimming with life and death, I suppose, and it's history and how it's changing. We are that. We are literally one of the things on that earth, and we count.
Yeah.
And that helped me a lot, thinking these types of thoughts when I would just wallow in my own pain at first, and then just go, well, wait a minute, also let's just put the lens back farther and farther and look at that.
Perspective. That's what happens to Charlie at the end of the chocolate factory. He goes,
oh yeah, absolutely, up in the glass elevator.
He goes in the glass elevator, he can see better, he can see more clearly, and when we see better, we do better.
Sure. I'm trying to think that a little bit because I'm not retiring yet, but I just turned 60, so it's soon. So I walk around and I have to go teach this morning, but just to try to capture, this is happening right now. And I'm still enjoying this, even though I'm stuck in all the minutia and all their meetings that I don't want to go to and paperwork that I don't want to do, etc. But also the realization that this part of life is happening. Let's acknowledge the largeness of it. And how cool is it that as soon as we depart here, I get to go and work with expressive teenagers that want to pour out their souls in singing because they signed up for the class. Are they moody? Of course, they're teenagers. But you're also capturing them. Maybe is there feelings that have not felt before, just because that's what happens in an adolescence. All of these things are churning all the time. And by coming up with a place to express it, that helps them. So in our world of adoptee land, something where we can feel what we need to feel, but not let it, I guess it's an art form, feeling it, but not letting it suddenly trap you in a way that you then can't do anything. What am I trying to say? So it doesn't freeze you up, but you accept. Not sure where I'm going with this. I think I'm waiting for you to jump in and go.
I'm going to take you back to the fog. I'm going to take you back to the fog.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, like there's out of the fog, there's in adoptee land.
Yeah.
Seems to me that there's only two phases, right? There's in the fog and out of the fog. Okay. Now, everybody knows what coming out of the fog means. It's when the suppressed trauma comes to the surface and you realize that maybe you've underestimated the impact. And who knows, right? For me, there was a huge relief coming out of the fog was a relief.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, I'm not going mad. There's a relief. Like when people get a diagnosis, there's a relief. But then, and it's like, I was thinking about this as I was swimming, right? So there's this, this lunchtime. So I was thinking, because I saw the lifeguard, I thought, like, stormy waters, confusion. What's going on?
Mm-hmm.
What's going on? What's going on? What's happening in my emotional life, to use your word? My emotional life is all over the shop. Read the primal wound. And it feels like a life buoy. It feels like what do they call them? Life ring, is it? What do they call them? The rings that they have at the
layers.
Sorry,
layer. I'm not sure. Do you mean layers? Like
no. I mean it's a life ring. It's a circular. It's like a hula hoop, but it's a. Yeah, life buoy, life ring. Right? It feels like a life raft. Let's go with that one. It feels like a life raft. Oh, right. Yeah, this explains everything. Okay. Yeah, it's all down to adoption, and but for me, instead of that life raft, the momentary relief of this diagnosis of the primal wound became more like a block of cement that kept me down.
Mm.
I had the primal wound. I was going to have to cope with it. I was going to have to live with it. It was set in stone.
Mm.
Nothing I could do about it. Really disempowering.
Mm.
And then I realized I came. So I was out of the fog into the mist. I still wasn't into the sunshine. And then when I realized that I wasn't my trauma, I wasn't this belief in the primal wound. That this belief, that this concrete block of trauma was holding me down, it released it.
Hmm.
It released. So I went from the fog to the mist to the sunshine.
Hmm. Oh, interesting. Yeah, you're not just opening a door. It's not the earlier scene in Willy Wonka where you open the door and you're in that. The chocolate room.
No,
it's
fog, mist, still not seeing clearly, right? Not being able to see clearly, not being able to navigate life well, not having a great emotional life, being hampered by the primal wound, being restrained by the primal wound, being held back by them, and then brilliant sunshine. And then some clouds.
Sure, because they're always, that's what I was going to say. That I like that analogy. They're always going to be clouds.
There's always going to be clouds.
That's a realization.
But you don't think that, you're not as worried about the mist rolling in. We're back to music now. Back to music. It was a Christmas number one, I think. Paul McCartney. Mullachintyre, or Wings, was it? Wings, Mullachintyre. A mist rolling in from the sea.
Ah.
My desire is always to be there. It's a beautiful place, actually, that Mullachintyre. We went on holiday there a few years ago. Beautiful, beautiful spot. And it was his getaway, you know, like it's kind of in Scotland, but he found somewhere, presumably he had a private plane. It's probably only like an hour's flight on a turboprop plane, if that, you know, from Liverpool to the Mullachintyre, which is in Scotland. Anyway, so fog, mist, brilliant sunshine, cloud. But when we see the cloud, I'm not afraid of the clouds. I'm not afraid of the mist coming back, because I've seen through the mist before. And that's what I mean by trauma being less traumatic. Because we're not afraid of the trauma anymore.
Oh, beautiful. There it is. Right there. That's why we should all listen to your podcast. To not be afraid of the trauma, but it's still there. Yeah. And you're right. That does make it less traumatic. Yeah. Because I really appreciate the connection with other adoptees. And like you said, you have the realization, I'm not crazy. This is what so many people, so many of us feel. And it's like as a team, we're all trying to figure out these feelings together. But knowing that here you and I are having this intimate conversation 6,000 miles away on a Wednesday morning / afternoon, it's therapeutic. Because it's not like you have this conversation with particularly anybody else. I probably won't discuss this with anybody else today, you know. Though, like I said, when
find a bus conductor, see if he's interested. Do you know what I mean? Get the bus to work and have a chat, see if the bus conductor is gonna
there you go. Yeah, ask anybody about that. Yet it is interesting, and you're going through this because with what we're doing right here, this podcast, somebody's going to listen to this. And they will know some of our most intimate feelings. And when I wrote the book, when finally you're working with your publisher and you're on your last, if you press this button, it means they actually are going to produce it and somebody's going to read it. That was a whirlwind of emotions too. Oh my gosh, I'm not hiding here with some feelings that I've discussed with very few people. But out it goes, and we're all courageous, and you don't have to talk to a million people. Just know that you're not alone. Know that other people feel this particular loss that we all went through, and what are they doing about it? And it's some serious work.
Yeah.
I do have to get going.
So before you go, would you like to come up with a name for this episode of the podcast?
Oh, wow. Okay, great. So now we're not being recorded. We have to come up with a name. Or are we being recorded?
You are being recorded.
Okay, so what would it be? I like your mist. I'm going to be thinking about that all day. I don't know. Coming out of the fog, working through the mist, accepting the sunshine and the clouds. That's a little too long.
Yeah. I'm going to suggest a four-word one.
Okay.
Making trauma less traumatic.
I love it. I love it because we're not saying, it's not like a weight loss pill. Take this pill and all of your problems will go away. Just listen to Paul and Simon and your trauma is going to instantly go away, but making it less traumatic. I love it.
Have a fantastic day. And
yes,
we'll speak soon.
Yes, please. Let's. This is really therapeutic.
Cool. For us both, my friend. For us both. And I hope it's been good for you guys listening. If you're still listening an hour in, it must have worked somehow.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, whether you're driving in your cars, listening to it on a walk or something.
Listening to it on a walk.
You're not alone.
You're not alone. Do 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 do. Right. See you soon, listeners. Speak to you soon. Thanks a lot. Bye bye.